Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
The Word is proud media partner of Latitude Festival. For more information and to purchase tickets, go to www.latitudefestival.co.uk.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Tony, what did you do this weekend?
Oh, what did I do this weekend? Well, it was... I took delivery of a Dalek, actually. Right, it's my wife's
full size
birthday this Friday. She loves the Dalek. She loves robots, actually. I mean, that's the obsession.
She loves
particularly
Dalek.
Daleks. It's not a whole Doctor Who thing. It's just, I know. And she likes robots. And she's got all these little sort of different, you know, small sizes, key rings and things of Daleks. And I thought, what can I get her for her birthday? Let's just go mad. So a couple of months ago, I found out the official BBC licensee for making Daleks. And I put an order in for a life-size Dalek.
And you took delivery of that this week?
I took delivery.
And where are you hiding it prior to her birthday?
I'm afraid one can't hide a Dalek that's full-size.
So you've already given
it's there. It's like, there's a guy outside, Sue. He's going to bring something in the house. Why don't you just go upstairs for about 10 minutes while he puts it together? Because it comes in three pieces.
Well, it goes procrastinate.
Can you get inside it?
No, you can't get inside it, and it doesn't flash on and off or anything like that, but it is life-size, if there is such a thing, for a Dalek. And it just looks absolutely brilliant.
So there you go. That's what you get for the woman who's got everything. Tony Wadsworth bought his wife, a Dalek. What did I do this weekend? Very boring. I went for a trip round the Olympic Park.
No, but that's not
that
bad.
Was the height of excitement.
That's not boring.
Official trip round the Olympic Park. Fraser, what did you do this weekend?
I did the dullest thing I've ever done. I went on a 2-hour 1938 tube journey, which was a vintage tube driving around West London, which would have been great for 10 minutes, but the passengers... I mean, I'm a music bore. I have that boring gene, but these people take it to another level altogether.
The tube ball.
My goodness. There was not a single wedding ring on that entire carriage. These people was just staggering.
What's the most boring thing they could say?
I was passing the Ealing Marshalling Yards earlier on. Lovely sea stock there. Air compressors, very rare, very rare. All that kind of stuff.
It was voluntary, right?
Yeah, no, I paid for it.
But it had various features that they don't have anymore. It had a guard, didn't it?
It had a guard, yeah. And he pushed
Do you remember the days when they used to have a guard on the tube train? It used to be in the back carriage.
Yes, they did.
Behind the small barrier, used to hand operate the...
Yes, that's right.
And he'd always lean out the door. While
strong smell of tobacco.
Until it just got into the tunnel and then nip back in.
Right.
Well, why did you do it, though? Because you must have known what you were getting into.
I thought it would be interesting, and it wasn't.
It wasn't. So now we'll know. So Mark Allen, who always has the most impressive weekend, tell us what you did on Saturday.
On Saturday, I was in Stoke Newington.
No, you did the full day, Mark. What did you do?
You mean Sunday?
Oh, Sunday.
Saturday in Stoke Newington.
So Saturday you went to a party
from Bob Dylan at a party in Stoke Newington in the garden, thinking in a way it's bad. Thinking, thank God I'm not there. It was sheeting down in Stoke Newington, and I could almost feel the umbrellas going up in Finsbury Park.
And the answer was blowing in the wind all the way across.
What I did the next day was I got up, as I do every year, on Father's Day, and we get up at 5:15 in a flat in Clapham, and we bicycle to Palace Pier in Brighton. Which we did, fact fans, in under 4 hours.
Do you still cycle up Ditchling Beacon?
All the way up Ditchling.
Do you know Ditchling Beacon?
Yes.
That's steep.
I tried cycling up it once, actually. It fell off.
Well, I'm sure a lot of people listening will have done the London to Brighton at some stage. Yeah. And they will know that when you get to Ditchling Beacon, which is 1.1 miles and takes about 12 minutes of absolutely crippling ascent. What astonishes me is that 90% of the people going up it get off and walk.
I will.
Lacking up in those funny shoes that people wear when they come
to
their bike. And they're all riding £1,000 bicycles. But the old Charlie Hawtrey brigade with Mark Ellen and their baggy shorts go herring up. Because what's the point in paying all that money if you can't ride a bicycle up a hill?
And so then you go to Brighton.
You get to Brighton, then you go straight into the sea.
How many people, Mark?
Only
how
one.
Many people went
in the sea.
Only one person.
Was he a
one of my pals actually went back
something
up onto
goon.
The, yeah, onto the water.
Was it
wind
you?
Windswept, you know, idiot.
You were.
Actually, I swam.
Were you covered in lard? Like a channel swim?
No, well, it wasn't that bad, actually. And then we paddled down to the Regency where we ate our body weight in battered fish.
God,
that's a probably good day out, I reckon.
I get exhausted just thinking about it. So that's what everybody's done at the weekend. This is the Word Podcast. Special guest, Tony Wadsworth. Tony, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Tony, various hats during an illustrious career, and currently chairman of the BPI.
Yep, chairman of the BPI, which goes with all sorts of other jobs as well, which is Brit Awards chairman and trustee of the Brits and governor of the Brit School and various other sort of bits and pieces like that. The BPI, for people that don't know, that's the body that promotes and protects the recording music industry.
The British Phonographic Institute, is that what it's called?
Not institute, industry.
Industry, sorry.
Yes.
So let's go back, Tony, because for years you worked at EMI.
Yeah.
Tell a good way of citing people on this podcast, we always think, is what records were in your house when you were growing up? Did your parents have loads of records?
And the answer to that is, there were none.
there were no
records in our house when I was growing up, because we didn't have a record player. But I spent a lot of time at my granddad's place, because he had a pub.
Ah.
Then he had a jukebox. And so that's where all the records were. They were on the pub jukebox. So from about 6 or 7, spent a load of time there. And I just remember his jukebox. I remember
specific songs?
Records, Paperback Writer by the Beatles, Spanish Eyes, Al Martino, loads of Tom Jones. That's sort of mid-60s, because I was born in 56. So it's early 60s, mid-60s.
There's something about the throb of music from a jukebox that is not any other kind of music.
No, it was great. Brilliant. And I think, you know, once I actually got a bit of money, that's one of the first things that I actually bought in terms of extravagance, was a jukebox. A word is a jukebox.
So from being born in the house that had no records at all, how did you end up in the record business?
Well, I was bought a guitar by my non-musical parents, which was really great, and that was my just big passion at school.
Oh, you were in a band, weren't you?
And I was in a band. I was in a band at school. I'd come from Bolton, so there was a couple of bands in our school. The one I was in and the one that Mark Radcliffe was in. Because he was the year below.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. Ask him which was better. Anyway.
What was your group called? We have to know.
Oh, you have to know. Our group was called Black Cat Bone.
Good names.
Not Bones, Bone.
Just Bone.
So you weren't a blues band?
Not very much, no. Oh, we were very much influenced by Johnny Winter.
Yeah.
Free.
Right.
All that period.
I can imagine.
And his was called Berlin Airlift.
Was there ever a kind of, I'm going to have to use the word, expression, sound clash, where the two of you met on some epic stage?
I believe...
one blew the other off.
I believe the barn at Rivington was the was the venue for us two playing together on the same bill. But anyway...
Were you the singer?
I sang and played guitar.
Fantastic.
And it was great. But everybody's in a band at school, aren't they?
Everybody.
So
everybody in the music industry has been in a band.
And then, so it's not really that interesting. They went to university in Newcastle and was doing economics, but really spent most of my time in another band. And that was a bit more serious, because after I graduated, I just carried on. That was my job.
In a band.
And
what was this actually attempted to make a living in a band?
Absolutely.
And what was this group called?
This was 1977 to 79.
David and I are already worried that we might have reviewed you from Record Mirror. Said how shit.
And I remember. No, I didn't.
And you would know that, though.
And we were called the Young Bucks.
Oh.
And we played. It was very much of that sort of pub, you know. Pub stroke new wave period. So we played all the Hope and Anchor and the Music Machine and the Marquee and Eric's in Liverpool.
Supporting who? What sort of people were you supporting?
We played with, I tell you who supported us on their first London gig. The Cure.
No. Whatever happened to them?
I think it was their first London gig, so at that place up Harrow Road.
Their first London gig was the Moonlight Club, I think, wasn't it? I was at that, yeah.
I thought this was their first London gig.
Yeah.
But anyway, it must have been early, because they were supporting us, and I'm sure they got beyond that pretty quickly. But
So in 1979, you saw sense.
In 1979, the band broke up, and I thought, you know, really, I'm not good enough for this. Because you do realise who's good. You see The Cure and you think, actually, these lads are pretty good. They're going to do all right.
This is good. They were brilliant. And he was only 17, wasn't he?
Absolutely.
There's a really interesting case of this that's in the current issue where they talk about Andy Murray's group, Stiff All-Stars and so forth, in the feature by Mark Hawkinson about people whose careers ended in the bargain bin. And Andy always talks about this, that they realised the moment had come to give up when they played Dave Robinson's Wedding and Madness were the support act. Madness were like 16 or whatever. And Madness made their way to the stage in a nutty train through the audience.
Yeah.
And the Stiff All-Stars were kind of older blokes and looked at them and thought, no, we can't compete with that level of ambition and brass neck confidence to do that.
Yeah.
You know, you realise some people are real, don't you?
And that is so much a part of what makes a successful artist, really, you know, that... And which I, you know, came to realise later on. But, you know, after the band broke up, I thought, OK, well, I'm going to have to get a job. But I'm not really interested in anything else apart from music, so let's try and get a job in the music industry. Look through Music Week, which is a trade magazine. First advert I saw looked vaguely sort of gettable. And went for it, which was in a company called Warwick Records, which is a bit sort of Ronco.
Was it A&R?
Yes, yes.
No, they did compilations, didn't they? Yeah, they're all compilations
TV
and TV
compilations.
Advertised stuff. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it was getting stuff made. It was getting stuff made at the factory and getting sleeves printed.
Assembling the parts.
It was production controller, I think.
He worked his way up. So that was the first.
That was the entry point. And I'd got no idea. I'd never worked in an office before. Went in there with, you know, I don't know, probably false references, who knows. Yeah. And they, you know, said, there's your desk. Will you need any stationery? I said, no, I don't need any of that stuff. Because nobody teaches you about the context
Absolutely.
Of an office, do
no,
they?
No,
you
no.
know, and I'd been in a band and signing on the dole for 2.5 years.
So how long were you at Warwick?
And I was there for about 6 months. Yeah. And then I did various small labels. I went to Logo, which was also Transatlantic Records.
That's cool.
Which was a great place to be, actually. But then...
Working with what sort of bands there?
There were...
The Tourists?
The Tourists, of course.
Stuart.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it was really... It was end of Empire sort of days at Logo Transatlantic, because they were...
Was Transatlantic run by Nat Joseph?
No. It had been. It had been founded by Nat Joseph. It was the big folk label.
It was.
And
Bert Jansch and so
he was.
And the people that owned Logo Records had bought Transatlantic as a catalogue. They'd made a lot of money from the Tourists. They were part owned by Marshall Cavendish, the Part Works
publisher.
Gosh, yeah.
And during my time there, which was another 6 months or 9 months or whatever, Marshall Cavendish decided were bought by somebody else who didn't think they needed a record company. So redundancy
beckoned.
So within a week, because it was like that then, I got a job at RCA. Doing a similar thing. It was all about, you know, getting stuff made. Because I did all of this within about 18 months. Went through all these various labels and ended up at EMI in 1982.
So what was happening at EMI in 1982? Who were the kind of big acts? Is that Duran Duran time?
I suppose it was Duran Duran time. Iron Maiden just started out.
Pink Floyd's?
Pink Floyd, The Wall had come out not too long before. But it was a funny old time, because, I mean, I don't know about you, but I wasn't too impressed by the 80s as a sort of decade, music-wise. And
if you'd been the editor of Smash Hits, you would have had a lovely time.
Hats
in. Oh, we had a riot.
Sky was black with
not haircut 100. I won't have a word said against Howard Jones, but carry on.
Well, this was it. There's all this sort of new romantic stuff, which I'm sorry, I couldn't really get myself get into. But I was... For about 6 or 9 months, I was doing the production controller thing. I was getting stuff made. They gave me a small staff of 3 or 4 people, which was great because they were quite old guys who'd been around when Mr. Lennon and Mr. McCartney used to come in checking the proofs of,
the first Beatles album.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Oh, so still EMI in those days still had the old kind of civil service hierarchy.
It was a period of transition, and there was a very much a vestige of that old EMI there.
Right.
They weren't quite wearing white coats, but they were wearing suit and ties, these guys, because you're talking about people in their 50s. They were heading towards retirement, and they'd been there ages. And And they were really quite traditional. But, of course, they had, you know, they had great stories. And, you know, you just sit there, tell me more about when you saw the Beatles.
Yeah, yeah. So, Mr. Gilmore was in only last week.
That young Master Gilmore.
Yeah.
So now you ended up the boss of EMI.
Mm.
For how long?
Mm. Well, I mean, the first real sort of big break, or the first real mark, was relaunching Parlophone as a label, because Parlophone had never actually hadn't existed since George Martin left.
Yeah.
You know, since he decided that maybe work, being on a salary wasn't the best way of earning a living from
which
the
he's
Beatles.
Still bitter about, of course, in
which
the documentary.
Which he still mentions.
Yes,
you know, fair enough, because his contribution...
He's got a chip on your shoulder. Yes, is his answer, wasn't it?
His contribution was immense. But since he left, that really Parlophone didn't exist as a fully-fledged label.
Yeah.
So it had been used as an imprint now and again by bands would come and say, oh, can you put me on that Parlophone label? But then in the late 80s, someone with a good idea thought, well, let's really try and make something of this. And by the time it got to sort of 91, 92, I became managing director of this thing called Parlophone. And who was on Parlophone at that time? We had the good 80s artists, like the Pet Shop Boys.
So you sort of went through the roster and said, can come and play on Parlophone.
I wanted to know who the bad ones were.
Well, I think that, no, because...
Where are you going, Duran
and Chris? Neil and Chris had decided...
Take one step forward.
Everyone is going to Parlophone.
Well, Neil and Chris had decided they wanted to be on Parlophone early on. In fact, they were probably as responsible for reviving it as a label as anybody.
Right.
But then it was making it a proper label, because to the outside world, you think, oh, these labels are full of people in, you know, one office called Parlophone with that, you know, Parlophone on the door. Not so. It's just being used as an imprint. But we made it into a fully rounded label. So we built it on things like... Pet Shop Boys and Morrissey, and we had Mark Almond there. We had then we had big superstar artists like Paul McCartney and Tina Turner and Queen. And
did you used to get them together for the Christmas party?
It would have been an interesting party, wouldn't it?
They'll put their arm around each other for the company photo.
Actually, later on in the 90s, we would have Christmas parties like that, and,
right.
and there were those sort of juxtapositions.
Right, right.
But. Then we really started getting into our stride with Parlophone. We signed Radiohead, Blur, which came via Food Records, but was, you know, a real Parlophone artist. We had Foo Fighters coming in from America. There's a lot of great artists. Right.
But you were in a very well, I don't know about a unique position, but a position that doesn't appear to exist anymore. I went to your leaving party, in fact, which must have been about 3 years ago now?
It was just over 3 years
and,
ago.
And Tony had a fantastic leaving send-off in Abbey Road Studios. And the number of musicians from the label that were there was absolutely... It was very impressive and very touching. And the various mates of Radiohead were there, and Damon Albarn made a wonderful speech. Tony's position was not just the managing director of the company, but obviously in a very... powerful A&R capacity, because I remember hearing from people like Radiohead that you still turned up at their, you know, their gigs and were there banging on the door, and even after you in fact left the label, I think you still go and see them.
I mean, I still keep in touch with a lot of them now, and in fact sometimes, you know, you might actually proffer an opinion about what they're doing.
But how did that come to, because I think most people listening would think that once you get to be the managing director, it's going to be a business thing, it's going to be somebody hunched over a load of spreadsheets and making executive decisions. So how did you manage to incorporate
with that? A lot of effort, really, Mark, because the default position, the higher up you get in a company, is to get completely embroiled in accountants and lawyers and business and let everybody else carry on with the fun stuff. And so I made, you know, a very active decision quite early on that I wasn't going to let that happen, because if you're in... I got in the music business not because I was into business, but because I was into music. So I thought... You know, I'm not going to allow that to happen. And so, but you do have to make an active effort to do that, because you would otherwise just be dragged into all day meetings with people who are going to tell you about this spreadsheet and that spreadsheet and about these new laws and so on and so forth. And that really is not why I got into it. I got into it because of music. So I made every effort to, as often as possible, I don't know, just to renew the soul a little bit sometimes, go down to a studio where one of these artists were playing and just sit there and have a chat with them. And you just come out feeling like you'd been, you know, reinvigorated. It was
so
fantastic.
Do you feel you made significant, to help make significant decisions? For example, single releases, you know, the track list and on albums?
I think there were... Maybe there are specific ones. I can think of one specific one which I mentioned a minute. But I think the main contribution that I think I made was gradually building an atmosphere that was conducive to creativity, because, you know, and give enabling people and empowering people. These are all sort of management words, but it's true. You know, you can't do it your bloody self. You're not going to sit there and say, okay, lads, you know, this is the way it's going to be. Here's the running order comes down from the managing director's office. Cheers. No, you've got loads of people working in these labels, and they're not. And if they're not working and making their own decisions, then what's the point of them being there? So part of managing a creative company is actually letting people be creative within that company, and then letting them enable artists and so on to have the freedom to create and make mistakes and so on.
Do you have to apply the judicious nudge in terms of working with artists? Clearly, you can't be ringing Tom York every day and going, "Have you got any new tunes? You know, they sound like hits or whatever." But you probably have to have one conversation with him a year or something like that.
You have, I mean, you do have this conversation, and not necessarily directly with Tom York, but probably with the band. But it's an ongoing thing, and that's why I tried to actually spend as much time with the musicians as possible, because I thought, well, an hour spent with one of these key artists is more important,
of course,
than a week spent looking at a bloody contract.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because I can't contribute much to that latter process, but right. I can.
Well, Damon Albarn very sweetly pulled out of his pocket a CD with some demos on it. So I brought these along, and I want Tony to listen to them. You know, yeah. That's really, really nice.
But yeah, but I mean, you know, some of the best times that I've ever had have been sitting in a studio with people like Damon and just talking about the stuff. And in fact, I mean, he's a special relationship, really, because he really welcomes you in, you know, and that's great. He really felt good about being on a record.
He wants your reaction.
But presumably, really does, you were the person who went to see Blur in the very early
days. No. I worked with them from the very first single.
Oh, right.
They were signed by David Balfe and Andy Ross,
who had Food
Records.
Yes.
And Food Records was a joint venture with EMI.
Yes.
But relatively early on in the process, Food then was bought by EMI, and David Balfe moved around about the second album, and Andy left a couple of albums after that. But I actively signed the Gorillaz project. I mean, that was the project that I really got behind, because that was a pretty big commitment.
I remember you saying to me a while ago, we were talking about singles on records, and you said that very often they come along later. That I thought it was really interesting light it shone onto the relationship between the record company and the artist.
Well, the pressure. Yeah, I mean, they do. I mean, there is a not. I don't know whether it's a famous story, but I mean, a few people would know the story about the second Blur album, where David Balfe, who was the Food Records guy, had got the whole album and gave Damon a bit of an ear drubbing and said, there's no singles on this. Go back and write some singles. And sure enough, he went away that Christmas a bit sort of forlorn and wounded. And came back with what turned out to be the first two singles from the record, which was For Tomorrow and Chemical World, I think. And on the Modern Life is Rubbish album. But I think a lot of... I'd like artists to actually... I think the whole thing starts quite early on. Is in the artist that you choose to work with. Because you actually want artists that can sometimes make that decision for themselves. And I do remember...
They can listen to their own stuff and go, this needs a single.
You know what? I think there's something missing here.
Yeah.
And I remember specifically the second Coldplay album. Now, if you can imagine the business pressure, the corporate pressure, the expectations, the stock market, and all of this rubbish, which is not really conducive to creativity, that's going on all around the waiting for the second Coldplay album. It was scheduled for a certain date, and we were down in the studio with the band. In fact, I think doing a bit of a pre-playback of a few tracks to some American media to get the whole ball rolling. The American media left, and we sat there with the band. And the conversation started about, you know, it's not all there, is it, really? This came from them.
Oh,
this came from them. And Chris Martin, you know, sat down and played this song that his manager at the time, Phil, said, you know, I remember this, you know, from a couple of years ago. Really, maybe this is what should be on the album. And
he played it on the piano?
Yeah, on the piano. And it was a song called The Scientist, if I remember rightly. And we held up the album for 3 or 4 months, which, you know, probably sent the share price into a spin, right, because right. That was just, you know, you're dealing with a special artist when they can make those sort of decisions for themselves.
Do you think that was in any way based on the on their reaction by the American media, that the American media has sat there and gone yeah, it's really good, in a way that is not exactly the tone of voice they're looking for?
No, not at all. No, right, no, they were all absolutely knocked out. It was that moment, really, and it was the beginning of Coldplay's moment. But they knew, and it is great. When you're working with very special artists like that, and Count Damon and Chris Martin and Neil and Chris and so on, they know more than most record label people, let's face it. And then when you're dealing with somebody like Paul McCartney, you know, his experience, or Mick Jagger, their experience of our business outstrips any record executive bar about two or three.
You've never been tempted to say to either of them, now listen, Paul, what I think you should do with this is this.
But there are some people who are legendary. I don't think you've ever worked with Brian Ferry, so I can talk about Brian. Oh, you have?
Actually.
Oh, right, OK. Well, just Brian Ferry, you don't have to respond to this, but for the people I know who've worked with him, Dave Stewart particularly, worked on, collaborated on various records and careers, they said he finds it, Brian Ferry finds it impossible, A, to know when to stop. This was a charge often laid at the feet of Bruce Springsteen. You know, you can carry on like artists, you know, just another dab of paint. You know, just leave it, it's there. And also can't filter out the good and bad, or the commercial and non-commercial. Because obviously if you're the person who wrote the songs, you just have particularly strong feelings about a certain song, which in the old days you might have deemed a B-side, and the record company are trying to advise you that to get a hit single is the advertisement that will get people to listen to that B-side that you so badly want to listen to in the first place. If you don't have the hit single, they won't. But there are certain people, Brian Ferry obviously being one, who...
Well, you've got this... You developed this theory...
Yeah, he's not saying anything, by the way, listen.
Well, we will. You developed this theory, though, in the office once, didn't you, that artists like making records, they just don't like finishing them.
Yeah, absolutely, I'm sure that's true.
Because they're kind of terrified of the judgment that comes with them being finished or put out.
I suppose so, but I can imagine an artist like Robbie Williams, who had this incredible run of success, and who was very actively involved in making his albums. He loved finishing albums because I don't think he particularly liked being in the studio.
I think he's different, though. My theory was that there's a sort of comfort zone and the studio is the best example of that, and it's a very, very inviting place because you can shut the outside world out, you can shut out any responsibilities as regards talking to your public. You don't have to give interviews. And a lot of musicians don't like the promotional circuit, you know. And we, journalists like us, expect them to be as eloquent and as effervescent and sizzling in interviews as they are when they write lyrics. Why should they be?
Yeah.
You know, they might be great stage performers, but they don't necessarily have to be a you know, classic bon mot and one-liner merchant.
No, it you're right. When and they are. Being in the
but
studio,
they quite like being in the studio.
It's a sanctuary.
Yeah, nobody can get them. Oh, don't disturb them. They're writing a masterpiece.
Yes. Yeah.
Actually, they're not. They're smoking an enormous business doing the crossword. In fact, two of the members of the band are asleep, but, you know, it doesn't matter. You know.
So during your time at EMI, Tony, I know you're a huge music fan. Do you ever sign anybody just because you're a fan?
Yes. It's Dr. John.
Oh, wonderful.
Because I could, so I did. And I met his managers. I think they were managing another artist. I think they were managing Cassandra Wilson, who was on Blue Note. Okay. And they were talking about Mac. And said, oh, you know, I don't know what's going on. And I said, well, you know, would he be free for signing? And, well, he might be. I think they knew he was going to be kicked off whatever label he was on at the time. And I just think he's just an incredible talent. And so I thought, well, I was in the middle of quite a strong run at the time. Nobody was asking any questions. I was making a hell of a lot of money for EMI.
So I thought, we're signing Dr.
And it was one of the best things, because you can't measure the value of something like that with you know, direct sort of.
Well, you can when the sales come in,
which are obviously modest, but also, you know, then, you know, other artists
He's a profile artist,
but it really does count for something, because people will actually say, you know what, I thought they were, you know, this label, when you're trying to get an act that is really in demand to sign to a label, they've got Dr. John. Yes. They've got this, that.
It does matter, doesn't it?
Isn't this great? Yeah. And actually, it really does matter because he is a musician. I mean, he's one of these guys that in any room that he's in, however famous everybody else is in the room, he's the centre of attention.
He's Dr. John.
He always
and
is.
And you're not.
Yeah, exactly.
But it indicates that this label has a soul, doesn't it? And cares for...
And cares, and has a soul beyond commerce, you know, beyond Babylon. It was fine. And it didn't, you know, nobody died. And it was... the first...
How long did he remain on the label?
he made about... It was a long and fruitful relationship. I think he did about 5 albums, actually. Blue Note in America.
You personally had to buy 500 copies of it.
No, he made some good albums.
No, but you also signed Richard Thompson, didn't you?
I did in the UK, and he had been signed to Capitol Records in America, and so we inherited him because we released Capitol Records material, and because myself and our head of promotion, my chum Malcolm Hill, were like massive Richard Thompson fans, then we sort of, you know, we took him over. He became ours. And that was fantastic because actually, best of both worlds. Although we weren't paying the bills, but we were working with Richard Thompson, so it was fantastic.
You made a load of very good records for EMI, which you were marketed very well, and you know, got behind him. Didn't really make an awful lot of difference, did it? Really?
I think it made a lot of difference to his ongoing value in the marketplace and selling tickets, etc.
I see.
And yeah, no, absolutely, because He's never really gone away in that respect. Yeah, sure. And I think the best thing we could do is you never expect him to be selling hundreds of thousands, but the best thing you can do is, because you know all the albums are going to be really good, is just make everybody aware of it, treat it with a certain amount of respect, and enjoy working with it. And that's it's actually good for some of the people in the label, the younger people in the label. I sound like an old git, but the younger people in there, but really enjoyed working with people like Dr. John and Richard Thompson, because it gave them a different perspective and it gave them a bit more depth in the way they thought about new music.
The Word Podcast, walking the digital dog since 2007.
Tell me, signing acts and watching them either flourish or go, or, you know, flourish and go, is it sort of like having... like having affairs or whatever? Does it always end... You know, it always ends in tears.
I think it ends in tears if you deal with it badly. I mean, there is obviously most of the artists that you sign are not going to become Coldplay. So, but I think that you've got to always remember that they, you know, you're dealing with human beings, you're living, breathing organisms. This is not widgets or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you try and treat people with as much respect as possible, and you might not be delivering them good news, i.e., you know what, we actually aren't going to continue with you. But if you deal with it like a grown-up and you front it up, then hopefully it's not a negative experience, you know.
But could it be said, from a journalistic point of view, you know, I in my experience, 30 years of interviewing people, 33 actually, musicians are enormously good at placing the blame elsewhere.
It's always the record.
It's the marketing. It's a brilliant record. It's the marketing.
There was a strike
of the pressing.
They ran out of plastic.
Yeah, we ran out of plastic. Yeah, it got on Radio 1 and they simply couldn't supply the demand.
New A&R man came in.
Yeah.
The company was taken over. It's everybody's fault.
It's an industry full of broken dreams, isn't it? I mean,
well, it is, and you know, record labels are a great repository for blame, and it's easy to do that. And yeah, absolutely, and it's a drag. But to be honest, and I'll be really straight, I didn't really get too much of that experience. You know, I can look a lot of artists in the face that I used to work with, and they'll say, you know, really enjoyed that time that we were...
Maybe as the chairman you were in a high-security panic room at the top of the building and you didn't have to deal with
an
it.
Emergency exit. Right, yes. An ejector seat.
Yes, they've been thrown out.
Yeah.
But give us an example of some of the groups who you just hoped had done better. I mean, you must have signed a lot of people, worked with a lot of people, and you just wish that they deserve more success.
I wish Supergrass had gone on to a different level.
Supergrass, brilliant.
Because Supergrass, and I actually bumped into them the other night...
they barely made a bad record.
They were so good musically and so creative. And in fact, on the first Dr. John album, they played on 3 or 4 tracks, which was nice to bring the old artists with the new artists. I just wish that they'd been appreciated more. But, you know, sometimes artists aren't necessarily going to enjoy that commercial success. But what goes into making an artist successful isn't just about how good the records are, as we know. I mean, you know, Nick Drake records being a great example. I think they sold about 2,000 or 3,000 each, didn't they?
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And they're amazing. But it's good. There are so many different ingredients, and you know, one of them is the steely ambition and determination of the people in the band.
This is it.
And I think it's such an important thing. And when you do, and it's not. It can sometimes be characterised as a bad thing. It's not necessarily a bad thing. It doesn't necessarily come in a bad package. You've someone like even Paul McCartney still cares passionately about whether he makes a successful record.
Oh,
or not.
He really does. Yeah,
and that's really striking. You just think to yourself, my goodness, the amount of success and kudos and so on that you've got, but you still want this.
Well, this
one
is
to
a,
be big.
A regular theme on podcasts. Pass him, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, our theory here is we applaud this, don't we? Elton John, Bobby. If you're going to do it wholeheartedly.
Yes.
But they've got to be fiercely ambitious, these people.
Yeah.
In a way that I think often fans don't give them sufficient credit for being.
Well, sometimes it's not cool to be fiercely ambitious.
But they are.
And, and you know, if you take Coldplay, for an example, even on the first album, Chris Martin, even within all the self-deprecating nature of him, was saying, you know, we're going to be the biggest band in the fucking world.
Yeah, yeah.
And
take some nerve.
Exactly what the A&R wants to hear.
And you do want to hear that. And you think to yourself, when people sit down in your office and you're thinking about starting a band, and they say that, you think, I want to, you know, hitch myself
in
your wagon.
Absolutely. There's a minor case of this I was thinking about this weekend with the sad death of Clarence Clemons, which is the key, when you look back, the key day in the career of Bruce Springsteen was when he went to the photographer's studio to have some pictures taken for the cover of Born to Run. And he turned up, not on his own, not with the band, but with Clarence Clemons. Now, knowing what you know about the politics of bands, that's a really high-risk manoeuvre, isn't it?
Absolutely.
You know, to say, no, you guys are not going to be in this picture, this guy's going to be in this picture, because two of us together make the picture, make the brand of Bruce Springsteen.
And no
marketing consultant told him to do that.
Completely.
Manager didn't tell him to do that. He knew
and
that.
It's the dynamic between the two of them.
And that's, again, it's potentially a very upsetting thing to do for the rest of the band.
But it's got to come from the artist. Because if you, as a record label, or as an artist manager or whatever, are constantly in the position of having to suggest to an artist what they look like and what their album should be packaged like, then you've got the wrong artist, frankly. You know, if you think back to, so we've mentioned Blur earlier, the second Blur album, they made, or you know, the band made, and Damon specifically made a very active decision that the time was right to reinforce Britishness. Now, we think about this now, and it's like, well, yes,
obvious.
So what? Well, actually, at the time, it was a really potentially incendiary thing to do, not particularly fashionable thing to do, but he really felt that this was being underplayed in society, and he was absolutely right, and it was saying, okay, there's all this American music that we all love, all the, you know, Nirvana and so on and so forth, but hey, we've got our own culture, and let's be proud of it, and we don't have to necessarily be, you know, right wing skinheads in order to be proud of British culture, and so let's reinforce that, and that came from them, and it was an intuitive thing which they pushed. And I think it's artists like that who really have a sense of themselves, of their potential and where they're going, that you want to work with.
And a big picture.
And a really big picture, absolutely.
You know, it goes beyond the quality of the songs.
That's it.
Tony, I want to move on to your... you're currently chairman of the BPI, and you've also written a... You now at the stage of life where you write reports for think tanks, and you've done a report with Eamon Ford occasionally of this parish about the potential future of the music business. Tell us about this. Done for the University of Westminster.
Yeah.
What's this all about?
What's it all about? So the University of Westminster have got this thing called Music Tank, which organises, you know, talking shops, conferences, seminars, and so on. And they asked me, would I do a report on the role of the record label specifically? And a big, you know, report. And so at the moment, what I since leaving my big job 3 years ago, I resolved to sort of make as many decisions to take me out of my comfort zone as possible. And so I said yes, and then I spent several weeks regretting having said yes, because I thought, how am I ever going to do this? Because it's 25,000 words, and I'd never written more than about 500 before, I don't think.
So you got Eamon.
I'm in Yorkshire. Yes. So I thought, okay, I'll call the good Dr. Eamon Ford. He can
buy
be my
biscuits.
My collaborator. Yeah, buy him loads of biscuits. He can be my
Red
collaborator.
Bull.
And, this is it. And I actually thought it would be a better experience with Eamon, because, frankly, I thought he would just write it for me, but he wasn't having any of it. He was great, actually, because he was, no, you've got to write it. You know, once you've done a chapter, I'll have a look at it, and we'll...
Ooh.
But he wouldn't, because I was just hoping he would say, tell you what, you do chapter 3, I'll do chapter 2, and it'll all be fine. No way. He just wasn't falling for it at all. So it was quite tough, but I'm glad that he did that, because by the end of it, I felt a sense of achievement. But anyway, that's a personal.
So do you feel that the record business has a future?
So, yeah.
Some people don't.
So and we're talking about specifically the record label, that was which is probably the most legendarily in jeopardy part of the music industry. And so and in conclusion, no. I don't think in conclusion, is it in jeopardy? No, it is in jeopardy. Does it have a future? Absolutely. And I tried to actually give a very, very balanced picture. I wasn't writing it as the chairman of the BPI, which represents record labels. I was writing it as Tony Wadsworth. And so I did, with Eamon, who had to transcribe them all, we did about 20 first-hand interviews with people all over the business, talking about their experience with music. And what became very, very clear is that with the whole shift from physical to digital, with the whole shift to of the economy from about the year 2000, where the music market stopped growing after that huge boom in CDs, there have been a lot of question marks about, okay, well, now we can all get our music to market directly. You know, we don't need these middle people. These gatekeepers have all disappeared, or they're not needed anymore. The record label is an outmoded concept. And I heard that so much, particularly there was a lot of clamour about it 3 or 4 years ago. And so I just really wanted to test that and just test it with not just people within labels, but with managers, publishers, agents and so on. And what became pretty clear to me was that the role of the record label is probably more needed than ever, because it provides filter. I mean, there is so much noise out there.
Yeah.
It provides a way of cutting through that noise with music that has been actually selected by people who probably know what they're talking about. It isn't enough just to make some music and just put it up there and think, well, if it's good enough, it'll sell. And
Because
I'm afraid that doesn't happen. And then if you look at it by example and just look at, well, okay, where are the examples of people doing it without a record label and being very successful? I'm sorry, there actually aren't any.
There are people built by record companies. You could even argue that your old pals Radiohead, in their last release, which I know you weren't involved with, which was put out by themselves, suffered from precisely what we were discussing earlier in this podcast, which is that they didn't have an outside agent going, for God's sake, change the sequence of this and change the rhythm of it. Put a single in there.
Well, I think that with Radiohead, I actually thought that both the albums they released themselves are really good albums, and it's...
They're great records, but they're not as considered, they're not as focused as they were with the record company.
But to put myself up as saying that I would have actually done them differently or told them anything different, to be honest, one wouldn't. I mean, Radiohead aren't that sort of artist. They're the ones that you've actually got to give them a context and some freedom and let them express themselves, and they do, and that's great. But what Radiohead did do was, they were the nearest thing to actually doing it without a record label that we've had. But let's, you know, first of all, it's an artist that spent 15 years with
a record
label. Secondly, actually, they didn't totally do it without a record label, as they would be the first to state, because they, after doing the initial digital release, they then were released in the UK by XL, which is one of our leading independent labels. They were released in America by another label. They had other label partners in different parts of the world for the physical release of getting the music into stores. So, you know, that they probably are the most extreme do-it-yourself artists and worked with 4 or 5 labels. yeah. in getting their music out. Yeah.
So yeah. what do you think? If we could, this is impossible to answer, and if people knew the answer, they'd be making a lot of money out of it. But in 5 years' time, what do you think? Because you're in a very central position here, and in a good position to be able to say, what do you think the main changes would be? I mean, will there be no CD market? I mean, what, are there going to be some fundamental changes? On
I think there'll still, I think there will still be a physical CD market. I do, however, think there'll be a it'll be a substantial digital market, massive majority. I mean, it's 50% in America already digital. It's you know, there's a huge penetration of digital in the States, and but in the in this country it's something like 30%, something like that, and it's going up.
But before you go any further with this, I think it's a very key point, because we get a lot of discussion about this on the Word website and elsewhere in the media, that can't there be an orderly migration from a physical product to a digital equivalent? And the people always say CD market's gone down by 30%, digital market's gone up by 30%, as if one made up for the other. Well, it doesn't, does it?
I'm afraid it doesn't.
Because a CD used to, you know, when the cotton was high, cost you £13, and you got the whole CD.
Yeah. and also, it doesn't work like that. But you do have to have some sort of order in that migration, because, you know, one thing's for sure, if we hadn't had a music market before the year 2000, if it hadn't existed, if CDs hadn't existed or vinyl hadn't existed, and this thing, you know, the file sharing or digital or downloading appeared, we'd be building this market faster than we are now. But it's because we have nothing to lose, nothing to protect. Yeah. And it's that. But the migration has got to take into account the old marketplace as well as the new marketplace, because the old marketplace is still providing the vast majority of the income. And to have some sort of, D-Day scenario where you say, OK, today we're stopping making CDs, it's all going to be digital, well, the income of the whole industry would just collapse, and the investment in new artists, this is where it gets really important, would just dry up. And it's the investment in artists that sets certainly the UK marketplace apart from most other countries in the world, because we invest in artists at a level where we know they've got a chance of selling around the world, because we're a worldwide player, and the only other country really is America that does that.
What do you mean by investment? Do you mean buying them the time to develop artistically, or do you mean
giving them the money to be able to giving them the money to be able to do this as a full-time job, giving them the money to make records, promoting them at an early stage, basically losing money for however long it takes before they might make some money, and that's a substantial amount of money. But that can only exist, that level of investment, if
but
there's
that
income.
Level of investment can't be as great as it was, because you could argue that there will never be another Supergrass. There just won't be one, because Supergrass was something that required gestation, wasn't it?
Yes, but I'd say that there
would
should
anyone have the patience for that anymore?
Well, there should be more of that, and I think that if the business started to, as the business develops, I think it will take advantage of the fact that no longer do you need to invest the levels per act that you needed to do. Because marketing and distributing digitally is a much more efficient way of doing things. And therefore, there is probably more likely that there will be a lot more Supergrasses around, and possibly less Lady Gagas. Because the investment that in something like a Supergrass is actually more economically viable in the digital world than it is in the physical world.
Right.
It's better targeted. It's more efficient. And so I think that there is a probability that there'll be a lot more artists at that level, but they'll be making money. It won't actually be regarded as a failure if you sell X amount of records.
What's the state of, we hear a lot about the 360 deal, where a record company ostensibly signs an artist, and they don't just own their rights or have a part of their rights to their music, they also have a bit of the T-shirt sales and their live revenue or whatever. Is that a model that's growing? I mean, because you did one of the first ones of these with Robbie Williams, didn't you?
Yeah. And that was, I mean, the Robbie Williams deal, you know, came about because everybody wanted to sign Robbie Williams at that time. He'd done a four-album deal with EMI. He was the biggest artist basically in the world solo artist at that time, even though he hadn't even broken in America. He was the biggest selling artist in the world, and solo artist anyway, and everybody wanted to sign him. He was out of contract. We needed to get him. There was going to always be a lot of money on the table. Whether it was £80 million, as he speculated, is open to speculation, and it wasn't. But it was always going to be a big deal, and everybody wanted to sign him. And so the deal had to be quite a special one. So in order to be able to make it more financially sort of rich, if you like, for the Robbie Williams camp, we devised with the Robbie Williams camp a type of deal which meant that we were investing not just in his records, but also in everything else that he did, from his live album, from his live work to his publishing, to just every what we call ancillary income.
Right.
Which, when you're an artist at that level, is not ancillary, it's most of your income.
Yep.
You know, records starts to become a minority picture, and that was justifiable because it involved a lot of money, and we became minority partners in the Robbie Williams brand.
Right.
And that was an exciting experience. The 360 degree deal, which is becoming pretty prevalent now, really comes from a different place, which is, look, record labels, I think it's the recognition which comes through in the report, the recognition that what record labels provide is marketing, is expertise, is contacts, it's bringing people together, and it's helping you actually, you know, get your thing going. And they spend more on the marketing of those artists than anybody else in the music industry. So if record labels' revenue is declining, which since the year 2000 it has been, where's the money going to come from? And so the recognition from artists that actually being on a record label, apart from selling records, is actually quite a good thing. Because, you know, when we were on a record label, we sold all of these tickets. And then when we weren't on a record label, it all dried up.
Yeah.
Go figure. So I think that there is a recognition that the record label provides this fuel outside of just, you know, the sales of CDs or whatever to your whole career. And the record industry, frankly, needs that additional sort of income in order to justify the expenditure that they make.
What Joni Mitchell called the star maker machinery.
That's right.
Yes,
behind
absolutely.
The popular song.
And so now, if you ask if it's growing, certainly the two biggest, the biggest company, Universal, and also Warner, I know both of those companies. 100% of their new artist deals in the last 12 months had an element of 360 degrees in there.
Right.
I.e., it had, you know, bits and pieces of different income. 100% of them. So from 3 years ago, it wasn't very common at all, and I think a lot of artists, managers, and so on felt, actually, no, this isn't your money. But I do think there's a recognition now that actually this isn't such a bad thing, because this helps your overall career.
Do you think the music business gets a sort of a bad rep for its response to the challenges of digital? Because everybody nowadays looks at the book industry or whatever, the film industry, and says, don't make the mistakes that those clowns in the music business
did.
That's
right.
And, you know, what's your response to that?
Well, my response is that we were the first.
Yep.
We encountered this massive opportunity stroke threat,
I suppose,
before anybody else. And there was, you know, there was no guidebook, there was no instruction manual, there was nobody, there was no example, no template, nobody had ever done it before. And so we were making it up as we went along as to how to deal with this in both a positive and a negative way. Negative being, you know, suing people.
Sue everybody.
Positive being try and get this digital business moving as fast as possible. You're inevitably going to make mistakes in an industry, and to say the industry hasn't made mistakes would be lying. But I defy any of those other industries that have been critical, and particularly, you know, the good gentlemen of the press were particularly now that they're encountering it themselves, they're sort of thinking, it's not quite so easy, is it? And but also, I'd like to think that whatever mistakes were made by the music industry, they're there to be learned from as well. And we were there first. And
was 1997 the year it all changed? That's the general agreement. The general consensus is that 1997 was when peer-to-peer came in. At that point, record sales began to plummet.
Well, they didn't. Actually, no, they actually no. Peer to peer came in about that time. Record sales didn't start to peak until after the year 2000.
So that was the last hurrah. Oh, really? 2000.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But
so it was 99 that Napster really took off.
That's right.
A little later. Yeah. Yeah.
So that's when that really took off. And you know, there's the apocryphal tale that the record industry just didn't want to do a deal with Napster. Rubbish. Of course the record industry would have liked to have done a deal with Napster, but they didn't want to do the deal that Napster wanted to do, because Napster wasn't one young kid in his bedroom, which he would like to be portrayed. There were investors behind that, and they had a different idea.
Yes, it's always been set up as a kind of Facebook-style evangelism, isn't it?
And they had a different idea as to how this investment in Napster was going to pan out. And so, you know, there was no deal done. And so history says the record industry refused to do a deal with Napster. It's just not true. But it wasn't until, 2003 that iTunes came along, and that was... It made sense, iTunes, because it was part of this constant... this consistent suite of different products, which all hung together. And it made buying music and playing music digitally very, very easy. And so that was, you know, that still is...
So you look upon it as a good thing.
It's a good thing and a bad thing, because what you don't want is a player in the market like iTunes as big and as dominant as they are.
Because Steve Jobs, you could say, runs the international music business. And he only thinks about it for 2% of his time.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't put it that way. But obviously, they're a very powerful force. And what we would like as the music industry is to have more and more people as successful as Steve Jobs.
That good would luck be with nice. That, Tony.
But what are you going to do when Steve Jobs comes around with his iTunes and says, well, actually, no, you're getting a bit too big, so stop licensing our music to you. That's not going to happen, is it?
Tell me one final thing. Still, although you have this massive, you know, downloading, legal and illegal, and you have this, you know, huge competition with all the other forms of entertainment, you know, so you don't have the classic old days of records selling thriller quantities and whatever. And yet you still have Adele, Coldplay, I don't know, there's probably other examples that still seem to sell in quite old-fashioned ways and in quite old-fashioned quantities. How do you account for that?
Well, I think that there are always going to be extraordinary artists, and that whenever everybody's making graphs about the way that industries go, they tend to actually neglect the extraordinary. And we're an industry that actually depends on the extraordinary.
That's a really good point.
And Adele's an extraordinary talent. Coldplay are an extraordinary talent. I mean, Coldplay's first four albums, each one sold more than the previous one.
During the time that the record business was falling off, that is so rare,
it's almost unique. And, you know, we're in an industry that is all about bucking the trend. That's why whenever you get so-called outsiders coming into our industry telling us how to run it, they get very, very confused, because it works in an unpredictable way. And I suppose that's what makes it exciting.
If you've been affected by any of the issues in this podcast, go to wordmagazine.co.uk or apply at your newsagent.